I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FU Network TV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com.
Hey, ladies, we are back after a brief COVID-related hiatus. No, I did not have COVID. I was just overwhelmed with all the extra work from COVID. And you probably are too, which is why I wanted to do this episode. It's a bit of a special format, only one guest this time, and she's a familiar face and or voice to listeners of the FU Network. Ishat Reza is joining me today. Ishat is a supervising lawyer at Law Hive. She's the co-host of Matter of Fact on the FU Network. She can be found on Twitter at Ishat Reza. Just look at the description box of this podcast if you want to know how to spell that. But Ishat is doing some COVID-19 related work through Law Hive. Ishat, tell me a bit about what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. What I've done is I have assembled a team of lawyers and law students, and the idea is that we're putting together a number of FAQs so people can look at the website and read up on some of the issues that people are facing right now relating to COVID and kind of some legal implications. And then if they don't find an answer to their particular situation on our website, they can also ask us a question. So we have a portal on there that people can send in some questions. And we just launched last week, and we've already started to get a steady stream of questions relating to people's employment situations, travel refunds, rental situations, family law related issues. And some people just have some questions on the various government assistance programs that are out there and that are new and coming on board. And so there's a lot of change. And obviously, everybody's having to adjust in many different ways because of the pandemic. And, it has made people think about, you know, what their legal rights are. And so we're able to offer this service for free. And it's a one-time summary legal advice thing that we're doing. And it's great because the students are super keen. They're very smart. And they wanted to be able to do something to give back to the community at this time. And I'm supervising them and working with a couple of other lawyers to make sure that we have, the salient information up on the website and that the students are able to provide a good service to those who send in a request.
Now, I will repeat, guys, she did say free. This is a free legal service. I think that's one of the things that's preventing a lot of people from trying to get informed on their rights, is they assume that they can't afford a lawyer. So what's the difference? And I find that most on the people who are getting a 25% cut in pay because their employer is going, well, the government's giving me 75%, so I'm cutting your salary back to 75%. Let's start there, Ishat. What does the law say about that practice? Can businesses do that?
That's the thing. I mean, it's unfortunate that some businesses are spinning what is actually a positive government initiative. So what the government has done is they've said that, you know, for those employers who are having trouble meeting their payroll, instead of laying off their employees, maybe what they can do is take advantage of the 75% wage subsidy. And the idea is there's certain criteria that the companies have to fulfill in terms of, you know, they've had a drop in their revenues, and there are certain formulas that they put up on their website. So, you know, companies can figure out whether they qualify for this wage subsidy. But what it means is that the government is going to subsidize people's salaries up to a certain cap of 75%. And what they're saying is, you, in order to participate in the program, you are encouraged to top up, you know, so that the salary is still at 100%, but the government is not mandating them to top it up in order to qualify for the program.
Okay.
But that is different than what people's legal obligations are. Like, in terms of employers, their legal obligations are still to make sure that they are fulfilling their employment contracts with their employees. And that includes paying them what you're expected to pay them.
Right.
So the fact that this wage subsidy program is there is not an excuse to suddenly drop people's pay 25%.
Now, are there tax implications on these companies who are abusing this program? Is it going to come back to bite them at tax time, do you know, if they cut the pay? Are they going to see a bigger tax bill if they don't use this program the way it's intended?
I'm not a tax lawyer, so I don't know what all the tax implications are. But from what I understand, it's not, because the government isn't saying they have to pay, that in order to qualify for this program, that they have to top up the salaries.
Right.
I don't think that there will be any negative consequences to companies that are doing this, at least not from the government's perspective. But legally speaking, and here's something that we've gotten from people in the public question saying that, you know, their pay has been reduced or their hours at work have been drastically cut, mm-hmm. and whether that's acceptable. And under the law, you can't do that as an employer. So what that means is when you have an employment contract with an employee, you have to fulfill all of that, meaning they have to work what they are, you know, they've signed up to work, you're supposed to pay them for what you've said you're going to pay them. Mm-hmm. If because of the economic situation, you're not able to give them the hours that, you know, they ordinarily had, that's kind of a different scenario. But legally speaking, technically, you can't just cut people's work and their salaries and so on. That's considered a constructive dismissal if it's done by more than, it depends on the province and there's different thresholds, mm-hmm. but in Ontario, for example, if you're reducing somebody's salary more than 16%, that's considered a constructive dismissal because you're essentially not meeting your end of the employment contract bargain.
Right.
So what I would say is, you know, it really depends on a person's employment situation, in the sense, like, if you're working for a small business and legitimately because of the pandemic and the like reduction in demand for the services that you guys offer, if in fact people, companies are having a hard time paying their people and they're saying, look, guys, everybody take a 50%, cut and we'll try to keep everyone on board or whatever. Like, I think people can be flexible because, you know, it's not like right now there are tons of jobs available. Mm-hmm. And so people can make decisions for themselves in terms of, you know, what the next best step is. They can, if they want, accept a reduction in their work hours or even in their salary. They can accept it. But they should know that in doing so, unless they say that I'm only accepting this for a specified temporary period because of the exceptional circumstances, if they don't say that, then actually you're changing the nature of your contract. And then you're kind of creating this precedent that in the future, like 3-4 years down the road, mm-hmm. assuming you're still working for the same people, they can reduce your hours and your pay again because you've already now set this precedent. So that's why what I would say to anybody who's in the situation where their pay has been cut or their hours have been cut, to make it clear in writing to their employer that they are only accepting this because of this particular exceptional circumstance, and to spell out for how long they wish to accept this. And so a guide could be, and everyone can decide this for themselves, but you know, because if they're collecting the CERB, which is the government assistance, if they're getting the $2,000 a month, maybe they can say, okay, this is 4 months, I can accept this reduction for 4 months, or mm-hmm. you know, however long it works for them. But the point is, an employer cannot unilaterally just make these demands and say, oh, well, now, you know, you can just go and apply for CERB, or you can do this or that or whatever. Like, it's still an employer's obligation. But one thing I will clarify, people who've had their hours reduced, they obviously don't qualify for CERB if they're making more than $1,000 a month.
Right.
Anybody who's making less than that, they would qualify, assuming they meet all the eligibility criteria for that. But so this thing of like whether you've had your hours reduced, or in some cases people have been temporarily laid off. Mm-hmm. But that's also something for people to know, that unless your employment contract explicitly states that your employer can lay you off, it's technically unlawful. Like, they can't just do it. The the provisions under provincial statute that talk about temporary layoffs and so on usually refer to those who are in seasonal employment, or, you know, whatever, and for whatever reason their employment contract allows it. Most people's employment contracts don't allow the employer to lay you off unless they're going to give you a payment. So usually it's they either have to give you notice and pay you for that period, or they give you payment in lieu of the notice that they're going to be terminating your job or putting you in this temporary situation. So So all to say, there's a lot that people are entitled to, but unfortunately, in under these circumstances, because so many employers have been affected, that they are just mass laying people off, and people don't realize that actually that's unlawful in many circumstances.
Okay, now let's move on, because I think we could talk about this particular subject for an hour. But again, anybody who has further questions on this topic, contact LawHive. They'll be able to give you information about your specific circumstances, because it sounds like it is quite like every
it is very specific to a person's exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing. And like unionized employees, it's different than, say, non-unionized employees, et cetera. So LawHive is LAWHIVE.ca. So it's like beehive, but LawHive.ca. So check on there. We have a whole bunch of FAQs on the employment related side of things, including on things like, you know, health and safety. Like some people are still going into work, like not everybody can work from home. And so those who are going into work are naturally concerned about their health and safety in the workplace. So, you know, we do have a couple of FAQs on that so people can know what their rights are. And then, yeah, we've also put a bunch of other topics on there. And then if you don't, you know, have an answer to your question, for sure, send us in questions. Our students are happy to take them. And like I said, you know, they are supervised and they're giving good advice.
Yeah. Now, also that was actually my next question. If somebody is called back into work and their workplace is in close quarters without appropriate social distancing or personal protective equipment, physical distancing now I'm supposed to call it, what are generally a person's rights to refuse to go back to work if they consider it's unsafe?
That's the thing. So it will be context specific. And also, I think as we move through the pandemic over the next few months, you know, we'll have to keep our ears out for what are public health officials telling us. So right now, what they're saying is, you know, we need to make sure we maintain at least the 2 meter distance. In many provinces, there's also a limit of, you know, you can only have so many people congregating in one area, and so on. And so all employers are going to have to follow whatever it is that the public health officials are saying that we need to do. And so employers are under an obligation to make sure they have a safe workplace for their employees. And that obviously will be somewhat of a subjective determination depending on the context. If you are having to work in relatively close quarters, you know, the fact that right now there is the physical distancing that we have to do, everyone's going to have to make sure they provide a workplace that allows for that. If an employee is concerned that, you know, the way that their workplace is being amended or whatever is not adequately safe, they then, like, they can't just make that determination themselves. They would need to signal to their employer, you know, I don't think this is adequate. And, you know, they could probably mention some reasons as to why. And, you know, it's helpful usually to point to, you know, public health is saying everybody should be doing X and we're not doing that, or, you know, that kind of thing. But ultimately, if the employer doesn't make changes that makes you think that, you know, they've addressed your concern, you can take it to the Ministry of Labor in your province and ask for an occupational health and safety inspector. Now, what happens there is that person would come in and, you know, do an assessment of your workplace. Until that assessment happens, a person can technically stay away from the workplace without fear of losing their job. Like, they have that legal right to make this request. The occupational health and safety inspector would come in, do an assessment, and then say, you know, yes, I think it's a safe workplace, or say that, no, I think these changes need to be made. And until those changes are made, you know, you don't have to go back. But once an occupational health and safety inspector has said, yes, this is a workplace that's safe, then legally speaking, you don't have the right to refuse to go back to work. You do need to go back to work. Obviously, take the precautions that you think, you know, will make it safer for you. As long as, you know, nothing conflicts with what your employer wants. You know, the best thing is always to try to have like a mutual agreement with the employer. And I would hope that most employers would, you know, be amenable to making adjustments to make things safe as possible for their employees. Because at the end of the day, I mean, if an employer is negligent when it comes to occupational health and safety issues, they could face liability if people get sick. Like, I mean, I'm thinking of that
meatpacking plants and yeah.
Exactly, in Alberta. And, you know, chances are there are going to be some lawsuits coming out of that situation. You know, I don't know the specifics of what went wrong or whatever, but, you know, that one is like an example of what you don't want to happen at your workplace, where you have this like massive outbreak. So, you know, I think from both the employer's perspective and the employee's perspective, it's important to make sure that when people are going to be returning into the same physical space, that they do it in a way that does protect people's health and safety. And certainly employers have a legal obligation to make sure their workplace is safe. And that's always, like even pre-pandemic, they always had that obligation. But what that means now is obviously different, because they're in a situation where, you know, we're having to make adjustments. We're so contagious potentially, you know, that that they're having to make adjustments. Yeah.
So if I understand this, you're saying somebody can't just go, I'm not showing up because COVID. You need a specific complaint, like they haven't separated the cubicles 2 meters apart. There's some sort of insufficient cleaning or something like that. You actually have to cite a specific complaint.
Yeah, you have to have some reasons to say that, okay, my workplace is not safe for this reason, that reason, whatever. It's not just, I just feel unsafe.
Right.
It's, you know, under the law, they say it's like, it's an objective assessment, not your subjective viewpoint on it. But obviously, you know, people will have their views on whether they think what the employer has done to make things safer is adequate or not. And, but at the end of the day, there needs to be this third party assessment, right? The occupational health and safety person has to say whether it's safe or not. Now, having said all that, you know, there are going to be specific circumstances. So there could be people who are at more risk because of their age or their health circumstances or so on. And that's a little bit trickier, because obviously in your specific circumstance, things may be different. And now an occupational health and safety inspector can take that into account.
Okay.
So they can look at it from your particular perspective. You know, I think people have to be reasonable and fair too. Like, for example, if the employer doesn't have an alternative, meaning like, let's say you work for a business that you do have to actually be in person, right? In a place in order to do your job. Then, you know, it's a different scenario than if you work in a job that you could technically work from home and it's the same, like it's not that different. You know, because it's all computer related work and you're all connected online and all that kind of stuff. So in that sense, you know, I think how you make the place safe can vary. You know, it will need to be somewhat of an individual assessment in terms of whether it is safe for you in that circumstance. Having said all that, you know, the other thing people can remember is that currently, because schools are closed, a lot of parents are not able to go into work, even if they were able to go to their jobs, right? And under our human rights codes in the provinces, you know, you have to accommodate, like an employer has to accommodate an employee's family situation within reason. And so, you know, right now, because schools are closed, obviously, you know, you can't leave young children. It's different if you've got like, you know, 16-year-olds at home.
Right.
But if you've got like 6-year-olds and 10-year-olds, it's a different story. They do need to be supervised and you do need to have at least one adult with them at home. And so employers are under an obligation to accommodate your need to be at home with your kids, because right now there are no options. There are no daycares, there are no schools that are open. And so in those circumstances, you can't lose your job over that. Now, if you can't do your job remotely, so working from home, then the employer, you know, has to accommodate you by allowing you to stay home, but they don't have to pay you for not actually working. But if your work is the kind of work where you can actually do it remotely, then the employer is under an obligation to accommodate that. So, you know, it will depend on a number of factors as to, you know, whether that could be a reason that you're able to stay home. That's something for people to keep in mind, that, you know, you are protected. And in Ontario, for example, they did pass a law that says, you know, anybody who is staying home to take care of their kids, they can't be fired for having to stay home.
Mm-hmm. Now,
but they don't have to get paid unless they're working.
Right. So, now, there's this theory, and it sounds a bit strange to me, which is why I'm going to ask you about it, by the federal conservatives, that people are just not going back to work because the CERB is too generous. This sounds odd to me, because any other time, tell me if I'm right about this. Any other time, if you are told to report to work and you just say no, they can, without reason, they can fire you for that, correct? Like, you won't have...
Oh, that is the reason. Yeah, that is the reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is the reason. Like, if people are supposed to be at work and they're not at work and they don't have a legitimate reason, like by law,
right,
to not be at work, then yeah, an employer can fire you for not showing up. But I think, I mean, from what I understand of the conservative line, mind you, I think they're just politicking here. Like, I'm not sure it's like a valid criticism of the PERB.
It sounded strange to me that, no, I'm not coming into work. Well, why not? I'm just not. Okay, well, you're fired. It doesn't matter if you're making less than $2,000 or not. There's certain conditions of employment that apply, correct?
Yeah, I mean, so that's the thing. So as, you know, as the pandemic thing gets under control and employers are able to, you know, call back their staff and so on, you do have an obligation to return to work unless you have a valid reason. So a valid reason would be an example of, like, let's say schools aren't open and
right,
you have no alternative and they can't, you know, there are no daycares and all of that. So in that sense, like, you know, that could be a valid reason to say, no, I can't return to work, and you can't get fired for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But if your reason is that, you know what, I'm just fearful and I'd rather stay on CERB instead, that unfortunately is not an option in that sense, because CERB is there for people who've lost their income.
Correct.
Because or had their income reduced so significantly, like, that it's under $1,000.
Right.
It's over. Yeah, that's right. So
you're under $1,000. Yes.
That's right. And so, you know, in those circumstances, CERB is there to help top you up for a period of up to 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have the option of returning to work, then you technically you don't qualify for CERB anymore if you would be making more than the $1,000, right?
Right.
So, the conservatives, I don't really think their argument is a valid one. I mean, I think, you know, for them to say that the CERB is preventing people from going back to work, I mean, that's kind of, I think that's just politicking, because honestly, most people who are on CERB are actually, that's a pay cut for them. Like,
yes,
most people, their gross income in a month would be more than the $2,000.
Correct.
And I'm sure most people do want to go back to work, but the main concern people have obviously is that their workplace is safe.
Right.
And you know, that there is a legal requirement for employers to make sure of that, as we mentioned.
So let's shift from work to home. And again, obviously every situation is different, but there's been a lot of talk about rents and mortgages and people worried about getting evicted, people worried about getting charged interest on missed rent. Say you are not bringing in any income. You are a small business owner who was paying themselves on dividends, so you don't qualify for the CERB, and you've got rent due, you don't have the money. What can you do?
Exactly. So, I mean, the first thing to do in these kind of situations is talk to your landlord or to the mortgage company if it is a situation of, you know, you own a home.
Yeah.
And see what you can work out. Now, there are certain programs in place where you're able to take advantage of a payment deferral.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of in the mortgage context. I think the banks are being somewhat helpful in that regard. But all a deferral means is you're still going to owe the amount. It's just you're going to have to pay it later when you presumably will have income again.
And they can charge you interest, correct?
I'm not 100% sure about that detail.
Okay.
I believe so, but I'm not too sure on that.
Okay.
But on the rent side of things, you know, the key really is to talk to the landlord and see if you can get some kind of a break. Now, whether it's, you pay it later, or you can only pay 60% now and you'll pay the rest later or whatever, legally speaking, you still have to pay your rent. Like,
right,
there isn't any kind of break being given to people because of the COVID situation. Now, certain provinces do have a rent subsidy program. It's not most of them. I know BC has something, and then there are a couple others. Now, you can check our website, lawhive.ca. We do have a housing tab, so click on there, because we do put the links to the provincial websites so that you could see what your province has and doesn't have and so on, because it's different according to where you live. But you know, there is that option of if you you know, if you're able to take advantage of some of the government programs. But unfortunately, people still have to, they still owe, you know, their rent. Mm-hmm. They might be able to get it deferred. Now, in terms of the issue of eviction, most provinces, if not all of them, have already issued some directives saying that, well, you can't be evicted right now. So in Ontario, for example, it's a landlord-tenant board that does these evictions. Mm-hmm. A landlord can still give you a notice to say that, okay, you have not paid your rent, it's owed, and if you don't pay within a certain period, you know, we can evict you. Right. A landlord can still give you that notice, but the way that would actually be enforced is by going through the landlord and tenant board.
Correct.
And they're not currently hearing those cases.
Right.
So there is a bit of time right now in which, you know, people are not going to be evicted under the usual process. So you have a bit of time, but it doesn't mean that you're ultimately not going to be liable for having to pay that rent. You are, as far as we know, based on, you know, the different programs that the governments have given. So what I'd say to people is, you know, if you find yourself in that situation, and, you know, I would try to find, like, what government benefits might you be able to qualify for, because there are a couple of them. So there's the CERB. There's also now this one for students. Specifically, and that just got passed in the last several days. So the details of that are coming up. We're actually going to be putting some more stuff up on our website on the student side of things. So, you know, just kind of keep an eye out for what other programs you might be able to get some income support on, because I think for most people who have lost income due to COVID, there will be some kind of government relief that you can take advantage of.
Right. So just to summarize, it sounds like the best thing to do is communicate, contact the mortgage holder, yeah. Contact the landlord, work something out. Don't just camp out and hope, because they could still push an eviction when the evictions, like, they can file the paperwork. They could still push it, right?
Down the road. I think I think basically that's what's happened right now, is like, it, for now, evictions are not allowed, but
right.
At some point it you know, they
right.
probably will allow it.
Right.
Yeah. But when I say some point, it's probably going to be months. Because in a normal circumstance, it still takes like several months in order for the process to, you know, play out.
Yeah.
So because there's a bit of a time lapse right now, that, you know, there will be, it'll be several months, but I wouldn't recommend like banking on that, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause it's a snowball effect. There's mounting consequences if you just don't pay rent. Moving on to sort of the final kind of big chunk of law that people might be dealing with, and possibly the most stressful, family law, especially co-parenting, visitation agreements, and so on. This is a very thorny thing. You know, even if you're not really financially hit hard by this, what to do, weighing your legal requirements versus your obvious concern for your children and trying to minimize risk for them. What happens in the circumstance of two parents who have a shared custody agreement and they have decidedly different opinions on how to handle COVID-19 self-isolation?
Exactly. So in these kind of situations, you know, the agreements that were in place pre-pandemic are still in place now. So if there was a situation where children are supposed to go back and forth between two homes, that still technically is the agreement that you're supposed to respect. Now, having said that, if the parents are able to come to a mutual agreement to change that, taking into account COVID, that's the ultimate best solution, right? Like, if you're able to come to an agreement on that. Now, unfortunately, what family lawyers are hearing right now, and we've gotten a couple of questions along those lines, is where one parent is concerned that social distancing isn't being properly observed in the other home, and what can you do, et cetera. So the first thing I'd say is, you know, obviously any decision that comes to you know, this sort of situation has to be based on what's in the best interest of the child, right? And so currently, the fact that the children go back and forth between two homes, it's seen as that's in their best interest to be able to spend time with both parents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given COVID and we have to have the proper physical distancing and other measures, precautions, you know, if you have a valid reason to think that the other parent is not actually respecting that when the children are over at the other place, then, you know, you do have some potential recourse. Now, the courts are not operating at full capacity right now. They are, though, listening to or hearing cases where it's urgent and in specific cases. So in a situation, say, and now every province is going to have their criteria. So, you know, you do need to look at it province by province. Or if you're not sure, you know, you can, again, get in touch with us at lawhive.ca and we can look into it for your province. But, you know, in Ontario, they have a criteria list of things, including, you know, if the child is in some kind of a safety, if there's some kind of safety concern for the child, and potentially, you know, if it is some gross disregard of social distancing at the other home, that could potentially be something to take before a court. But the point is, you would actually have to have a proceeding in order to change your access agreements right now.
Right.
You can't just unilaterally do that or just say that, oh, I don't think social distancing is happening at the other home, so I'm not going to let my kids go there. That's not technically, you know, allowed. So there is still a process in place, but, you know, ideally people should try to come to an agreement. I understand it's not always possible, yeah, but that's kind of the best case scenario.
Yeah. A big issue in family law is people go into it thinking it's about creating a fair deal for the parents. My understanding is it's not. The court advocates for the interests of the child. It doesn't care terribly much about either adult in the situation, correct?
I mean, I don't know if I'd put it that way, but it is correct that, you know, decisions made in the family court are centered around what's in the best interest of the child when it's about the child.
Right.
So that's exactly the case. And you know, like we got a question where somebody was asking about her concerns, her own health concerns, and, you know, the fact that her children would be going to another home and then coming back to her home. And she has certain health related concerns. But you know, unfortunately, that's not really a reason to go before a family court to change your access agreement. It's again, centered around the child and what's in the child's best interest. So, you know, one could argue that in that case that, well, maybe then the child should stay in the other home the whole time or something, you know, or again, come up with an agreement between the two of you. But unfortunately, in these circumstances, you know, often the adults
can't get along,
can't make decisions in an amicable way. And, you know, that's very hard. That's a very hard situation.
No.
There's actually another area. I know, you know, family law definitely is like a big area, but travel refunds. Can I talk a little bit about travel refunds?
Yeah, actually, one question and then we'll close on travel refunds, because I know a lot of people are interested in, just on the family law point, if you're not making any money anymore or significantly reduced money, do you still have to pay the pre-agreed upon child support amount?
So on the child support, we do actually have an FAQ on the website, and we had a family lawyer come up with those. So I'd rather for people to have a look at that and then you know, ask a question if you need something more specific.
Okay.
But generally speaking, you know, your obligations toward, like if it's child support related, are again still there until a court, you know, decides otherwise, right? So that, just kind of keep that in mind. But obviously, when people's income does change, their obligations owing on support do change as well. But it's not an automatic,
right?
Is all I would say. Yeah.
Okay.
As a general point.
So getting on to that travel refunds, I knew quite a few people who were waiting, wringing their hands. They didn't want to cancel their cruise because that means they wouldn't get their money back. They had to wait for the cruise company to actually cancel the trip. So what is going on with travel people can now not take because of COVID-19?
Exactly. So the first thing I would say is, you know, you got to read your terms and conditions of whatever the, wherever you purchased your travel ticket. So, you know, for the cruise, check that one, the cruise terms and conditions. For flights, same thing, check those. In general, what I would say is, you know, in Canada, if the travel organization offers you a credit, which is what they're tending to do, like they're canceling and then they're offering credit.
Yeah.
As long as the credit is going to be valid for a reasonable period of time, like most of them are offering it for around 2 years. The Canadian Transportation Agency has said that that's seen as reasonable.
Okay.
So you kind of have to take this credit and you've got 2 years to spend it. But in some cases, your agreement may actually permit for a refund. But I think right now in Canada, anyways, it's going to be tricky for people to try to get an actual full refund. They may be able to get a partial refund. A lot of it, you know, you got to ask your the people that you purchased your ticket from to see if they're amenable to it. But first, look at your terms and conditions to see if there's something in there that you can point to, and so on. But in Canada, people are going to likely have to take this credit instead of the refund. But good news for those who are either traveling to the States or through the States, the under American law, the companies are actually obligated to give you a travel, a full refund in these cases where they cancel. At least that's how the law is as of today. They may change that, you know. But yeah, you're in better luck if you were traveling to or through the States. In the EU, it's the same thing as in the US in that, you know, the travel provider is required to give you a refund. But that also includes, so that's for all European EU travel like carriers,
right?
But also for any carrier that had a trip that was originating in Europe. So if you bought a ticket on Air Canada that was Paris, Toronto, Paris, that's considered under European law. So then the EU law would apply there. So again, look at our website, lawhive.ca. We do have a travel section, and see if your answer is there. And if not, you can write to us and we can look into it for you.
I'm actually surprised there's that much you can do, because anybody who's ever dealt with an airline or a travel agent or something like that, getting refunds on travel is, getting blood from a stone is easier, even at the best of times.
Well, the rights have gotten better, I would say, that, you know, the rights for travelers has improved over time. And, you know, they are obligated right now, like if they're not going to be offering you the service, which obviously in many cases they can't right now, that they do have to give you something back, and whether it's a refund or a credit, it'll be one or the other.
Right.
But they do have to give you something back.
They have to give you something. They can't just, too bad you didn't take the trip.
Oh yeah. No, especially if they've canceled the trip. No.
Okay. All right. Ashat, is there any area I've kind of missed? We covered a lot in a pretty quick period of time. Any other major area affected by COVID that you'd like to talk about?
Well, just I would mention, you know, the government assistance programs that are out there, they've come out very fast and they've also changed. And so if you have any questions, you know, you could visit our website. We do have a tab on that, and we've made a couple of links to other resources where they're kind of collating all the differences and they're updating the changes. And of course, the government websites are, you know, important. So Canada.ca is one for the federal government and all their various programs. But the CBC, for example, has done this really interesting tool where you can choose your province and then you can sort of describe your situation, and then it gives you a list of different programs that you might qualify for, because there are many things out there. I mean, there is the CERB, there's the wage subsidy, there's the student thing, but there are many other things that have been announced. And so keeping track of all of that can be a bit tricky. So you can look at our website for some of those resources. But at the same time, you know, we're also happy to try to help you figure it out as well. I mean, we're also learning as the government adapts and changes what they're doing as well. But, you know, we're happy to try to help you with that too.
Yeah. There seems to be a new industry specific program every day, keeping up with
it as a
full-time job. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Ashat, thank you so much for the advice. Let's give out the credentials for people. I'm sure there's a lot of people, but. So let's give out the information one more time for Lawfare. How can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, so for the Law Hive, it's LAW, that's good. It's LAWHIVE.ca. We're also on Twitter under C as in the letter C and then Law Hive, LAWHIVE. And so you can find, because we'll give updates every time we put new stuff up on the website and so on. But, you know, just come check out our website and, you know, hopefully we'll be able to help you out. And again, you can tweet at me, although I'm not always catching all my tweets, but I'm at Ishat Reza on Twitter.
But you'd prefer people go to the C Law Hive Twitter account, correct? for this
for sure for the updates and so on, and then you know send us a message on the ask us a question if you have anything specific that you want us to look into from the website.
All right, wonderful. Thanks so much for your time. And guys, check out Matter of Fact. It's a super great podcast on the FU Network as well. This has been Hey Ladies on the FU Network. Support us on Patreon, patreon.com/FUnetwork.tv. A one-time PayPal donation through our website, FUnetwork.tv. Or you can buy some merchandise through store at FUnetwork.tv. Issat Reza, once again, thanks very much for your time and helping us through this labyrinth of government programs and legal things, and it's confusing, and I'm very proud of professionals like you helping us through it.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much.
This is fun! The FU Network.